Welcome, everyone, to the Third Wheel, Herbert Smith Freehills podcast series exploring all things ESG. I'm Bella Kelly, Senior Associate in our Head Office Advisory and ESG practice, and it is my pleasure to be back at the wheel as your host today. It's my very first time back in the driver's seat after the birth of my first baby, so hello world, it's great to be back. And I think it's fitting then for our theme for today's episode, to say, you know, hi to 2024 and to gaze into our ESG crystal ball and discuss predictions for this year. And there's so much to discuss. A lot has happened already this year. And as always in the world of ESG, there'll be plenty more to come. Now, for our episode today, I am turning the table on our regular Third Wheel hosts, Mel Debenham and Tim Stutt. Hi, you two.
Hi, Bella. Welcome back.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
It is great to have you. And you know what? I love nothing more than a little bit of hypothesizing. So this is a perfect start to 2024 in my view.
And are we going to be talking about the bundles of joy which await us throughout
That's
the year?
Right. In theme.
I think yeah. Your introduction has set a very high bar for what we might expect over the course of the year. But we'll stare into the crystal ball and see what we can find.
All right, well, let's begin. The crystal ball is fired up. And as we gaze into that fired up crystal ball, let's cast our predictions across the three realms. We have E, we have S, and we have G. On the E side, let's start with you, Mel. So Australia is working quite hard to meet its climate commitments, and we're seeing an increasing emphasis on renewable energy and a lower carbon economy. What's emerging for you this year?
That is certainly the case. And last year was definitely a story of ambition, I guess. Lots of projects in the development phase, much investment, and I guess a step change in activity. But the trick to getting decarb projects up within the window of opportunity is timing. And to quote Jack Burton from Big Trouble in Little China, this is going to take crackerjack timing. So I think a theme in 2024 will be the levers that can be pulled to affect that crackerjack timing versus the suite of regulation, be that environmental, certainly a big part of regulation applies to these projects, but also otherwise. And much of that is subject to reform. So when I look into the crystal ball, Commonwealth environmental legislative reform absolutely comes into focus for me. And maybe just to recap, the Commonwealth legislation is the EPBC Act, and it was subject to a 10-year review process in 2021. It was led by Graham Samuel. The Samuel Review identified numerous issues with the Act and the outcomes it achieved, and has made recommendations accordingly. Now, in the lead up to the last election, so we are back in 2022 now, Labor committed to providing a full response to the Samuel Review plus establishment of an independent environmental protection agency. So that EPA would be responsible for compliance and assurance, cop on the beat, essentially, as well as improving environmental data and information and associated analysis. We had a change in government, and Labor then released the Nature Positive Plan, which is a bit more meat on the bone of its reform proposal. And it's really significant reform. So wholesale replacement of the existing EPBC Act, an introduction of a very different approach to regulation, notably swapping out decision makers and having the EPA not just serving a compliance and assurance function, but potentially also the decision maker for projects. So consultation is ongoing. It has been ongoing for a while, but we're yet to see draft legislation publicly. And I anticipate that will drop middle of this year. It's probably too early to say what this all means for development, be that renewable energy or otherwise, but what I think it will draw into stark relief is that need for very careful balancing of biodiversity considerations against other drivers like climate. So, you know, it is in 2024, it's a much more nuanced conversation that we're having compared to previously. And with any change in regulatory settings, you should just expect teething issues. So coming back to crackerjack timing, I think we should expect with new legislation timing implications and the potential for delay. Tim, what's coming through for you on the E?
On the E, I think it's climate reporting, climate reporting, climate reporting, which is coming towards us like a runaway train. Interestingly, though, there is quite a bit of discussion in the market at the moment around whether or not the 1 July 2024 start date is realistic. And there was sort of a delicious carrot dangled in one of the consultation packs put out around the possibility of moving to a 1 January 2025 start date. And I think there's even some discussion around whether it could be 1 July 2025. So there is timing uncertainty. I think certainly, though, in terms of the conversations we're having with clients and the work which we're engaged with them on, everyone is planning for the worst but hoping for the best in terms of timing. I think we're now at a stage where the scope of the uplift required is becoming apparent to quite a lot of people across the market, and it really has been driven by the way in which the reporting standards are framed. So previously, a lot of large companies reported against the TCFD, which had 11 recommended disclosures and then quite a bit of guidance sitting behind it. But it was pretty common for companies to sort of focus primarily on the recommended disclosures, and they hadn't necessarily drilled down to all of the aspects of the guidance. The process of moving towards mandatory climate reporting in Australia means that a lot of that guidance is becoming operative parts of the standard. And that's really sort of driving a lot of extra detail and a lot of focus, not just on what happens or who is responsible for something happening, but having to talk quite a bit about how it happens in practice. So, for instance, rather than identifying just who is responsible for overseeing climate risks, how does it happen in practice? How many meetings a year? How are targets set? How are trade-offs considered? How is the linkage to REM KPIs looked at? How are skills and competencies on the board assessed? There's just a lot more how questions, and that is driving quite a considerable amount of uplift, moving from the sort of succinct, snappy, this is how we oversee it, to talking about how it's happening in practice.
And I think when you take a bird's eye view, Tim, you've got this uplift required from a reporting perspective, additional regulatory oversight. There is quite a lot happening in the e-space, and businesses have got limited bandwidth, right? So, interested in the observations you made around timing, because I wonder as well from a Commonwealth environment regulation perspective whether we might see some timing shift there, now that the enormity of the reform task is being better understood as well. So just interesting what you're seeing from a reporting perspective. I can really, really resonates with me from a regulatory reform perspective.
I do think even in terms of the reporting, for a lot of companies, it's sort of seen as a head office issue. But the reality is a lot of the data sits in the assets, it sits in the business lines, and that it is a whole of business exercise, and I think that's just starting to be felt. Some companies are significantly ahead of the curve because they are climate exposed, or they have poured a bunch of time and effort into this area for the purposes of meeting stakeholder expectations and so on and so forth. But for a lot, actually now is the time in which they're sort of looking at how they set up some of those data systems and how they flow some of the sort of central governance and risk management type concepts throughout the business. And that's a pretty big challenge. I should say the other area which is interesting too is because the climate reporting standard gives equal airplay to risks and opportunities, the opportunities part is a real area of focus too. So a lot of companies didn't necessarily have as solidified frameworks for considering opportunities. Yes, intuitively, they have a process where things get fed through into, say, investment decisions or to the ELT or the board. But actually, in having to document how it works in practice and talk about it at that granular level, that's proving to be a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, it's a bit, it's not like having a risk committee and a risk assessment framework, right? Opportunities are a little bit more nebulous. And I guess a bit tricky as well from a, you know, forwards looking perspective.
Well, and that's another area which is I think going to get a bit of airtime throughout the year. Forward looking statements and you know, the reality is that the climate reporting regime has a lot of forward looking information embedded in it. And while there had been sort of a number of industry discussions around safe harbour or modified liability, where we've landed in the most recent exposure draft of the legislation is pretty skinny. So it covers scope 3 for the reason that you're relying on third-party data and scenario analysis. You know, that's a step down from previously it was scope 3 and transition plans, which at least covered your forward commitments and your pathways to get there. I think the extent of the forward-looking information is going to continue to be an area of focus, and particularly in the context of the report is really just the start in some ways, because you need to have reasonable grounds when you make a forward-looking statement. With the report, companies intuitively know that they will have to have a higher level of verification and evidence gathering and so on and so forth. But then in the coming months and years that follow that, actually the risk of repeating those statements and relying on that work is that the world changes around you, and what was true at that point might no longer be true. And, you know, we can see that with the potential for technology changes or regulatory changes or capital costs. There's just a range of different levers. But that ability to sort of monitor those statements on the way through the year to make sure that they're being kept up to date and that you're not at risk of saying something which you no longer have reasonable grounds for, that's a bit vexing and something that a number of companies are sort of considering how they might implement processes to tackle that one.
Tim, I think we're going to have a dedicated podcast episode on climate reporting and turn the tables on you again. But they are, I mean, Mel and Tim, you both raised really big ticket items for Australia, right? Complete overhauls of regulation, entirely new regulation. And to add to that, I also wanted to mention this is also entirely new in Australia, is the sustainable finance strategy. So that underwent consultation end of last year, and we have a podcast episode on that. But I think we can expect some of those pillars of that strategy to be further progressed this year. And a big standout for me is the sustainable finance taxonomy, which is, you know, helping the market understand what activities align with or contribute to good sustainability outcomes. And obviously that's relevant to investors and lenders who have their own corporate or product strategies around that. It's also relevant to businesses looking to attract the capital that's earmarked for those sorts of activities. It's also relevant in terms of businesses sort of creating their own methodologies, underpinning their own definitions of what's green, what's sustainable. And my prediction is that the taxonomy is going to act as a sort of a backbone in much the same way that the EU taxonomy does. So other initiatives are going to hang off it, like the sustainability labelling framework that's also being proposed by the strategy. And whilst, you know, we can expect it to be initially voluntary, I think what's important to kind of consider is that there could be disclosure requirements in the future associated with it. And again, like we see in the EU. And I think eventually there's going to be that sort of disclosure in any event, whether it's mandated or not, by virtue of market pressures, right? So Probably not one for 2024, and I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, as is often the case. And perhaps let's revisit that.
I don't know. We all have to draft it during 2024, don't we? Isn't that the plan?
Oh, well, there you go. There you go. Thanks for making me relevant, Tim. Now onto the social sphere. In the past couple of weeks, we've all seen the media reports around the recent release of Australia's pay gap data by the Workplace Gender Equality Agency. We've also seen the release of the fifth edition of the ASX Corporate Governance Principles and Recommendations for Consultation, which emphasises the importance of diversity on the board and throughout the workforce. So I think we should expect to hear more in 2024 in terms of removing barriers to participation and achieving better gender balance across the economy. But Mel and Tim, what are some of the other social trends that you're expecting this year?
Bella, for me, look, it's less a trend and it's more, I guess, an evolution. But the shifting landscape post the Voice referendum, and I want to acknowledge that there is still a lot of disappointment and hurt within the community in respect to the referendum. And certainly, I have no hypothesis as to what we will see post, but there is now a question for the Commonwealth, as well as individual states and territories and the Australian business community and community as a whole, how are we going to respond? I think regulatory reform will absolutely be relevant here. So from a Commonwealth perspective, there is ongoing consultation on new or amended cultural heritage laws. I think naturally that will have a look back to the Voice in how First Nations people participate within the structure that is established. But there are also consultation requirements specific to First Nations people that are being contemplated as part of the new Commonwealth environmental regime. So that will be something I expect to see a bit more clarity on this year. The South Australian Voice to Parliament is also getting closer, and that's a key example of state-based implementation of the Uluru Statement from the Heart. Elections for representatives are actually happening this weekend on the 16th of March, so something to look out for. Many will be looking to the South Australian Voice, its success or impact, and whether this is a model that can be adopted in other settings. Similarly, the ongoing work of the Uruk Commission and its investigation of injustices to First Nations people in Victoria is going to feed into that treaty process and may also set a benchmark which is relevant around Australia. So, as I said, no hypothesis from me or prediction, but I've got no doubt that the post-Voice pathway will become a little bit clearer during the course of 2024.
For me, and this might seem like a bit of an odd prediction, given at the time we're recording this, the EU Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive is sort of teetering. I think technically there's 4 more days that they could make it work. Oh, I shouldn't mention the number of days when we're recording this. That puts a lot of pressure to get this episode out promptly. But it seems a bit of an odd time to say it, but I think that concept of human rights due diligence, modern slavery due diligence, and ESG due diligence more broadly is something we'll continue to hear a lot about throughout 2024. We talked a little bit about it last year in terms of reform of the Modern Slavery Act, and we're sort of now at a stage where the government has introduced legislation to Parliament for the purposes of appointing an anti-slavery commissioner, and that person is intended to lead consultation on reform of the Modern Slavery Act and the recommendations put out by Professor McMillan last year. And modern slavery due diligence was probably one of the kind of marquee recommendations of his report. But separately, we're starting to see other limbs of diligence feed through to things like the ASX Corporate Governance Council's principles and recommendations. Not directly, but even in terms of some of the recent proposed amendments which are out for consultation. The fact that one of the recommendations picks up disclosure of de-identified issues raised under codes of conduct, and that they would form part of a company's public disclosures is interesting, and it's sort of a step along from where things were previously, which was you needed to have risk processes, but now we're sort of at a stage where you're also reporting on the issues which have come up under them. That creates a real sort of impetus for diligence processes to stitch that together, the sort of identifying the risk, the managing those risks on the way through, and then being in a position to sensibly talk about what's happened at the other end. You know, we talked about with modern slavery and where things are now, the fact that once you have to identify your modern slavery risks and what you do to manage them, it creates a real de facto diligence obligation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can sort of expect to see a bit more of that coming up in different forums in different ways. We're also starting to see a bit more of the duty to prevent type approach, which requires diligent systems sitting behind it. You know, most recently, we saw that with the obligation put on employers in relation to preventing sexual assault and sexual harassment. Now, we'll also be seeing it in relation to anti-bribery and corruption as well. And there's been movement on that legislation after several previous misfires and a lot of years, but actually we're going to be seeing it there as well. And I think these themes are all sort of consistent. They're all around diligence and how do you manage these issues in practice, and then how do you talk about them publicly as well.
Yeah, and then the stick that applies if you don't get it right. And so, you know, with the legislation that you've mentioned, the compliance side, the exposure is really significant, right? So getting it right, making sure that you have processes to support compliance across the board is has never been more critical than today.
I do think even in terms of some of the areas where there's not a clear diligence obligation, we are starting to get questions around, you know, what sort of process, if a court or a regulator were to look at it, what sort of process would be considered whiter than white or clearly reasonable or clearly appropriate in the circumstances?
That's a hard question.
It is a hard question. Usually we go swimming in the case law and all of the different regulatory guidance and then form our own views based on what we've seen in practice to arrive at an answer to it. But those types of questions are coming up because there is this sort of pressure to have integrated, well, sort of, or consistently rolled out diligence processes, but then there's a bit of a gap around what they should look like in practice, and fairly scary consequences where they're deemed not to be appropriate, or worse, where you lack them.
I think we've probably, Bella, strayed into a conversation about G inadvertently, which, you know, Tim and I are prone to do, and it really does emphasise the interrelationship between these elements. And from a governance perspective, you know, that's relevant across the board. And to get ESG right, I do think you need to be thinking about it as a singular concept, opposed to the spheres or silos that we've been thinking about today. Rather than sort of leaping on to talk about G independently, I thought maybe we could talk about government as the last theme, because it is an election year, and election years are always interesting, because ESG themes, whether explicit or implicit, play out in all manner of ways. And I think, you know, this year I'm really expecting to see energy policy implications balanced against cost of living. I've got no doubt that that will play out ahead of the election. But also perhaps sort of looping back to the beginning of our conversation, and I think I made a comment about, you know, more nuanced consideration in 2024. there will be, I think, a bit more conversation around the balance that's necessary to strike in delivering on our climate ambition, but in a way that has appropriate regard to biodiversity, potential social impact of new infrastructure, be that renewable or transmission, modern slavery, waste, circular economy. I think some of that complexity might start to play out ahead of the election as well. What are your thoughts on big ticket ESG issues in the election space, pre-election space?
It's a good question, Mel. I agree with all of that. I think I'm not sure we've fully grappled with some of the trade-offs and some of the nuance. And I'm hoping that maybe we can get to a more sophisticated approach to things. It is difficult in the context of an election year, though, because actually it's much easier to deal in campaign bylines and slogans rather than grapple with what are pretty complex, difficult issues. I'm sort of on the same wavelength with you there, Mel.
Well, thanks very much, Tim and Mel, for crystal ball gazing with us today on the third wheel. As is our tradition, we'll highlight an interesting fact from the world of ESG to close. And today's one is on topic and ties in with the ESG governance piece you were talking about, Mel, how it's all interrelated and we need to view it holistically. And the fun fact relates to a new analysis of ASX 200 board charters, which Herbert Smith Freehills undertook in January for the Australian Institute of Company Directors. That analysis reveals a 10% increase in the number of dedicated sustainability committees within governance structures of Australia's largest listed companies. And that increase indicates that environmental and sustainability related issues are steadily becoming core governance priorities among more ASX listed companies and across industries. The analysis was published as part of the AICD's second climate governance study, which was released earlier this month. We'll include a link in the episode notes along with an earlier guide we prepared with the AICD to help directors and management elevate ESG matters to the board. And that's all from us. Thanks everyone for tuning in.
In the spirit of reconciliation, Herbert Smith Freehills acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today. You have been listening to a podcast brought to you by Herbert Smith Freehills. For more episodes, please go to our channel on iTunes, Spotify, or SoundCloud, and visit our website, herbertsmithfreehills.com, for more insights relevant to your business.